You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock. I am your host, Alex Smith. You'll get full spectrum coverage of both the economic mess and the environmental meltdown. We'll travel to Wall Street, Tokyo, and your future. Our sources come from underground radio, offshore broadcasts, and a new tide of citizen journalists in the blogosphere. Canadians sure know what falling money feels like. Losing 20 cents against the American dollar in just a month? Ouch. The same thing is happening in Australia, to the euro, and even worse for developing countries all over the world. It's yet another phase of the prolonged crash we are experiencing. This time, right now, it's the currency squeeze. The American dollar is going up, which is unbelievable, considering how bankrupt that country is. The Japanese yen is going even higher than that. Both are considered safer currencies than anything else, so people are going there. However short-lived this currency game may be, it is causing financial earthquakes all over the world. For example, if you borrowed money in most of the developing countries, foreign lenders didn't trust the Nigerian currency or the Mongolian, whatever their currency may be. So they all set up debts in terms of U.S. dollars or the Japanese yen. Now the U.S. dollar is skyrocketing as debts come due all over the world. It costs far more to repay them. That hits foreign companies hard and even foreign governments, as we'll hear shortly. Canadians who borrowed with repayments set in U.S. dollars would pay 20% more, for example. People, business, and governments overseas likely won't be able to pay at all. That means more massive defaults on loans. When loans default, the banks, hedge funds, and insurance companies like AIG have to pay out more, and their assets drop. When assets drop, these banks and investment houses have to raise more capital to meet government requirements. They may be forced to sell off stocks to do it, or real estate, when the prices for both are already tanked. That means more downward pressure on stock and real estate prices, you know that. And it again reduces the assets of the bank or corporation. More forced sales result in a dizzying downward spiral. We'd call it a positive feedback effect, except there's not much positive about it. The dollar is also going up out of sheer panic all over the globe. Big investors are hauling their bucks out of hedge funds and even the money market at record rates to buy the alleged safety of U.S. Treasury bonds backed by the American taxpayer. To buy U.S. Treasuries, you need U.S. dollars, and that is another factor driving up the American dollar, even as the U.S. corporations report horrible earnings or straight-up losses in the billions of dollars. It's all upside down. The impact of the rising American dollar is great, possibly fatal to some governments and businesses, but the cost of the soaring Japanese currency is likely the final blow to our current understanding of the capitalist dream. Why? Let's listen in to a clip from Max Keiser. Max is a former Wall Street banker type who left the U.S. more or less in disgust to live in Paris and then London. He does a radio show on the alternative Radiance FM in London. The piece we are about to hear was on Al Jazeera, of all places, the only outlet that would broadcast Keiser's radical talk about economics. I found it through an American underground show called Unwelcome Guests at unwelcomeguests.org. That's a great program, incidentally, hosted by Lynn Gary and broadcast on 21 college and community radio stations in the U.S. Lynn often rebroadcasts segments and speakers from Radio EcoShock, too, another way this program gets out there to a North American audience. Anyway, here is Max Keiser explaining, in easy terms, the strange phenomenon called the yen-carry trade.
Over the past few years, borrowing money via the carry trade has seemed risk-free. But recently, central bankers have been warning that if the yen or the Swiss franc rise, prices can move against investors rapidly and even destabilize the global financial system. Max Keiser investigates in Iceland.
Iceland's been buying a lot of Britain's high street recently. How does a country with less than 300,000 population, who's got a GDP of $13 billion, less than one-tenth the size of Google, end up buying hundreds of billions of dollars worth of valuable properties here in London and Britain, including the West Ham Football Club?
I believe this financial miracle comes from cheap credit, a fancy word for debt. Never in history has the entire world been so awash in debt. And all this debt begins, many say, with something called the carry trade. This carry trade usually begins in the currency markets, otherwise known as the Forex markets, the biggest market in the world where $3 trillion worth of trades happen every single day. I'll show you how the carry trade is done. First, I need to borrow some money from a country with low interest rates.
Let's flip this coin to decide. Heads, Tokyo. Tails, Zurich.
Tails, Zurich.
Whoa! It's a little bit too much on that one. The Forex market can be a very dangerous place. You never know, day to day, what kind of trades you might encounter, what kind of danger might be out there. Zurich, of course, one of the most dangerous towns in the world, if you're not lucky. Here's something I can do. With these Swiss francs, I can actually perform a little bit of Forex legerdemain. By taking these Swiss francs, and then by jumping back into the Forex market, and coming out in another town, I'll show you how we can make some money. Well, so, the currency in Zurich has been magically transformed into the local currency here in Iceland, the Icelandic krona. And I immediately pick up 5-7% of my money. I didn't get this money by manufacturing or producing or savings. I just got it from interest rate speculating, interest rate arbitrage. Economics appears to have gone through a radical transformation where the king is the speculator and the chump who's caught working for a living in a factory is considered yesterday's news.
Today's news is debt. More and more consumers, corporations, investors, and speculators are taking on more and more debt thanks to low global interest rates. Glenn Stevens, governor of Australia's Reserve Bank, said of Japan's near 0% interest rate policy, quote, "There is something very strange about a G3 country giving out free money. This has an effect on global markets. It is by no means clear that it is a healthy state of affairs to persist."
Dr. Paul Walker, CEO, GFMS Limited.
The governor's probably on the money there, that when you have a situation where the Japanese are effectively giving away their cash, you can borrow it for free, for all intents and purposes, or maybe a few basis points, that does have global implications and necessarily would hold the global interest rate environment lower than it otherwise would be.
So all this borrowed money doesn't always end up in the currency. A lot of it goes into real estate, it goes into art. A lot of it goes into fueling mergers and acquisitions, which is part of another piece of the global bubble. It's all so easy with free money. What could possibly go wrong?
You know, whether it's 0% or 2 or 3 basis points, it doesn't really make a heck of a lot of difference because it's still debt. And ordinarily, when there's huge demand for debt, the price of debt or interest rates go higher. But what we're seeing now in the global banking cartel is an agreement, more or less, that when there's more demand for debt, they simply make the parameters to borrow less stringent. They never close the debt window. So what we have is asset bubbles. We have house prices and art markets and stocks and bonds going up in price, but not as fast as the level of debt. So the wealth is completely illusory, unless, of course, this is some kind of financial anti-gravity machine and debt never means anything for the rest of our lives, which, of course, is impossible. Every once in a while, there is a reconciliation in these markets, and you do have the asset bust, the deflation, and the occasional depression.
What should happen in a global economy? You should be rewarded for savings. That's what your parents taught you. That's what you learn in Economics 101. What's happened in the last 5-6 years? You're not rewarded for savings just by putting your cash into interest-bearing assets, because in the U.S., you've got negative returns on that in real terms. Why would you bother doing it? You have to look elsewhere. And this is not just true of the man and woman in the street. It's true of corporations and investment funds. You've got to look elsewhere, which is why you've seen asset bubbles appearing in housing. That's your man in the street who's able to participate in that quite easily by buying housing.
Tell you in America that you've got a healthy economy, and yet you've got 2 straight years of negative savings. They talk about wealth being built up in people's homes, and yet the foreclosure rates have never been higher. They talk about people achieving the American dream, and yet poverty rates are skyrocketing. It's all nonsense.
So, we're in a world in which speculators are making money by borrowing virtually free money from Japan or Switzerland and investing it in markets, assets, and currencies around the globe. And the man on the street is, quote-unquote, getting rich from the asset bubbles caused by all this borrowing. Asset prices have never been higher, but debt loads have never been even higher still. So how long can this laissez-faire tale last?
The carry trade revolves around being able to borrow an asset, and when you borrowed it, you sell it, you take the proceeds from that, you invest it in another higher yielding asset. But of course, the key consideration when going into the carry trade is that the asset that you're borrowing, you're effectively shorting it, that asset's not going to go up in value.
That's right. This carry trade scheme does have one potentially lethal problem. It's called unwinding. If the borrowed asset, in this case the yen or Swiss franc, starts to go up in value, the carry trade stops working because the cost of the original loan goes up. So everyone around the world, the bankers, the investors, and the speculators, tries to cash in their inflated stocks, bonds, currency, and real estate investments at the same time in order to pay off that low interest rate debt before it rises further in value. It is a run on the global banking system, an extremely ugly situation, and warnings about this unwinding are coming fast and furious from central bankers around the world.
Jean-Claude Trichet, the head of the European Central Bank, said in February of 2007, quote, one-way bets, and of course by this he means the carry trade, in the present circumstances would not be, it seems to us, appropriate. We want the markets to be aware of the risks they contain. Malcolm Knight, general manager of the Bank of International Settlements, the central bank of central banks, quote, there is a rising leverage in the financial system, and we have some very crowded trades in some areas of the foreign exchange markets. Mr. Knight said, speaking at the World Economic Forum in Davos, quote, together, these could create the potential for a very rapid repricing in financial markets. Crowded trades. Well, this is Fed speak. Crowded trades in the sense means that, according to the bankers who run the banking establishments, maybe there's not enough suckers left to make this thing really work. So he's telegraphing for those in the market to maybe get out of the market now.
Tim Lee, PI Economics.
The most famous case of yen carry trade unwinding we've had occurred in 1998 at the time of Russia, when Russia defaulted on its debt, and a large investment fund called Long-Term Capital Management basically went bankrupt, and that triggered in markets an unwinding of carry trades at that time, and the yen appreciated extremely rapidly when that happened, and some people have been concerned that, you know, we could have a repeat of that this time. But I think if I'm correct, then the size of the carry trade now is much larger than it was then.
Dr. Paul Walker.
But it's been a fairly substantial trade over the last few years. It will be, it could have global ramifications, there's no doubt about it. But it does revolve around one key question. What is the size of this trade? And we don't really know, because discerning and splitting out the genuine trade-related activities in borrowing yen and the, if you like, the speculative, because the carry trade is simply a speculative activity. Until we can split those out and get the data sets on those adequate, we don't know. But I think there are signs out there that there are worries in the global economy.
Analysts, economists, central bankers, and politicians are warning us of the dangers of an unwinding carry trade and one-way bets. So why do speculators and investors keep playing recklessly in the carry trade traffic?
People are perceiving that there isn't that much risk in doing these this borrowing in low interest rate currency. The risk of a rapid exchange rate movement occurring in a short space of time isn't very high. And I think an important factor that's contributed to that is past intervention in the currency markets by central banks, particularly, and we're talking about the yen carry trade, the intervention that the Ministry of Finance and Bank of Japan did over 2003-2004, when the yen would have risen substantially at that time, but the Bank of Japan, on the orders of the Ministry of Finance in Japan, stepped into the market and prevented the yen moving above about the 104, 105 rate when it was going up.
Market intervention. That's just another word for market manipulation. These bankers are keen to keep rates low by making credit available, but they have two very devastating effects on the global economy. Number one, they are penalizing workers whose pension funds are being put at risk, and they're also making it impossible for the natural supply and demand curve to come into sync in the global markets, and debt is building up like hot magma of hot money. It may look tranquil, but once it blows, look out. Financial analysts and bankers argue that the financial carry trade must be allowed to continue because we almost enjoy the wealth and asset appreciation that it creates. But the wealth and asset creation is the result of massive yen carry trade. So their arguments are specious at best, and it's doing a lot of damage along the way to the workers, the savers, and the global economy, which is exposed to way too much risk.
Our view is simply that the central banks of the world have been putting off the day of reckoning. Their interest rate environment has enabled them to sustain this. The buying up, for example, of U.S. debt has been a key component, the key pillar globally of these imbalances that have emerged. But the longer they delay this, the more serious the day of reckoning is going to be, and it will come.
Well, here we are back on a high street in London. What do we learn from all of this? Well, what we know is that the Icelandic krona is the global financial currency of the month, the flavor of the month club. Hot money in, my guess is going to see hot money out. Thailand, remember that in the late 90s? Didn't last. And of course, what will happen to all of these brokers and bankers and private equity groups and hedge fund managers once the party's over? The punch bowl is taken away, and Iceland no longer has the hot currency of the month.
Max Kaiser reporting for Al Jazeera English TV in August 2007. The URL of his website is a bit difficult on radio, so your best bet is to Google Max Kaiser, spelt K-E-I-S-E-R.
Keep in mind, Max did that program back in 2007. Pretty well every day, I find some banking expert on TV saying, well, no one could have predicted all this. Or they say the same thing to Congress. Well, really? In fact, there were almost too many predictions of the crash. Nouriel Roubini, a professor of economics at New York University, detailed exactly why the financial system was unstable and would crash hard way back in 2006. The mainstream media tried hard to discredit Roubini, calling him a kook. Now that he is too right, the financial press and TV channels feature him regularly. Find this key document titled The Rising Risk of a Systematic Financial Meltdown, The 12 Steps to Financial Disaster. It was originally published February 5, 2008 by Nouriel Roubini at his website, rgemonitor.com. His update of October 8th is available free online at his site, and the original is all over the net. 12 Steps to Financial Disaster by Roubini. I'm Alex Smith, and this is Radio EcoShock. But now it looks like mainstream media is becoming less the bully we thought it is. It's becoming irrelevant and insolvent. Take this news item. The famous organ of America, the New York Times, may very well join thousands of other firms in bankruptcy. The Times has over $1 billion in debt that needs to be rolled over in a market where nobody is lending. The newspaper reports having only about $46 million in liquid assets. Newspaper advertising is not just decreasing, it is plunging. The same is happening to newspapers all over North America. One of the biggest sponsors of the papers, and of TV news, I might add, are the car companies. Huge full-page ads and tons of TV commercials selling those heavy SUVs and pickup trucks that make you a real man. As you know, those American car companies are failing, likely headed toward bankruptcy. Truck and SUV sales, which provided most of the profits for those companies, are dead, dead, dead. Few people know that the U.S. Congress slipped in an extra $25 billion for the American car companies just a few weeks ago. They put it into a spending bill in October. The money was supposed to pay for conversion to greener cars, hybrids, and electrics. But few expect the companies to last that long or to spend it on anything green. GM is in a last-ditch negotiation to merge quickly with Chrysler, which is basically going out of business, shutting plants all over. GM has also approached the government to help facilitate that merger, which no doubt means more billions in loans. Ford is also losing multi-billions of dollars every quarter. Getting a car loan in the U.S. has become a major adventure, even in Canada, if you can get one at all. There are lots of big cars sitting around the lots not selling. The failing car companies are trying the last advertising, but it's not going to work. If you look at Canadian newspapers like the Vancouver Sun, the pages are shrinking in size almost by the day. That's good news for trees, of course. Part of the problem? In the old days, there was a saying you could measure the health of a newspaper by the amount of classified ads it carried. The classifieds are shrinking to almost nothing, being replaced by Craigslist, eBay, and other internet sources. Full-blown newspapers may not be able to carry on, and they know it. Ditto at least one big U.S. TV network. I use YouTube for almost everything. Why bother with all those commercials? Once the hundreds of millions spent on U.S. election advertising withers away in November, we'll begin to see the pain in the mainstream media financial reports. That means, ta-da, we will depend more and more on localized volunteer media, on citizen media. That is already happening to a degree as networks like CNN try to add more user-provided video, the iReport phenomenon. Getting back to the financial crisis, here's a novel explanation of the problem. It comes from a hedge fund CEO named André Lahde, spelled L-A-H-D-E. André is the bright boy whose fund Lahde Capital made 866% profit last year by betting on the subprime collapse. Last month, after making countless millions, André Lahde closed his fund and went home. He left a goodbye message on the blog called FT Alphaville. André suggests the current mess is only partly criminal greed. The rest is just stupidity due to the promotion of Ivy League families. In other words, we may be experiencing the failure of financial aristocracy. They promoted their sons who, just like George Bush, weren't really all that bright. André Lahde writes, "I was in this game for the money. The low-hanging fruit, i.e. idiots whose parents paid for prep school, Yale, and then Harvard MBA, were there for the taking. These people, who were often truly not worthy of the education they received, or supposedly received, rose to the top of companies such as AIG, Bear Stearns, and Lehman Brothers, and all levels of our government. All of this behavior supporting the aristocracy only ended up making it easier for me to find people stupid enough to take the other side of my trades. God bless America. I now have time to repair my health, which was destroyed by the stress I layered onto myself over the past 2 years, as well as my entire life, where I had to compete for spaces in universities and graduate schools, jobs, and assets under management with those who had all the advantages, rich parents, that I did not. May meritocracy be part of a new form of government which needs to be established." That's the end of a quote from André Lahde. Meanwhile, the famous $700 billion bailout in the U.S. has turned into at least $2 trillion of funny money pumped into the banking system. Few Americans will actually see it. Some of the American banks are using bailout money to buy weaker regional banks. For example, PNC Financial Services Group used $5.2 billion of taxpayers' money to buy another bank, National City Group. That makes PNC the fifth largest bank in the U.S., so you're paying for a conglomeration of power. Other failing banks in the U.S. are hoping Canadian banks will save them. Royal Bank, Toronto Dominion Bank, and Bank of Montreal already own and operate some U.S. consumer outlets. Royal Bank alone spent over $2 billion Canadian dollars on U.S. acquisitions, such as Flag Financial in Atlanta and Alabama National Bank Corporation. Toronto Dominion just spent $7.5 billion to buy a New Jersey bank called Commerce Bank Corp. the Canadian banks have been more stable due to tougher regulations and less stupid behavior, but will that last if they keep buying weak or toxic American banks? It's not just the banks. Now falling, national governments in many parts of the world. Earlier in this program, we heard about Iceland and the risky bets made by recently denationalized Icelandic banks, partly using Japanese currency exchanges. The economy of Iceland has basically been crushed. The banks were nationalized again a few days ago, but the Icelandic government is not as big to survive the debt. For the first time since 1977, the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, has been asked to save a Western developed country, Iceland. Stranger still, police departments and municipalities in Britain, not to mention zillions of personal savers, have their money tied up or lost in UK branches of those Icelandic banks. According to the Guardian newspaper, 108 councils in England, Scotland, and Wales had deposited £798 million in Icelandic banks. For example, 15 different British police departments went for the high interest rates offered by the Icelandic banks, but now can't get their money out. The situation is so extreme that the UK government used some weird anti-terrorism law to freeze Icelandic bank assets in the UK, a last-ditch effort to recoup some of the money. Which shows how pervasive these secret anti-terrorism laws are. Maybe they will shut down the banking system for a week or more due to the danger of economic terrorism?
How can we know the time of crisis has arrived? Is the panic heart beating? Or is it only mine?
Think I'm joking? People like the Prime Minister of Italy, Silvio Berlusconi, suggested shutting down all stock markets for a period while rearranging the whole world financial system. Many other serious people have wondered whether a bank holiday would suddenly be proclaimed if the silent runs on the banks continue. That is, people are removing billions upon billions of dollars from money market accounts, from weak banks, using ATMs and online banking. You will not see the lines of people around the corner as happened in the 1930s for a bank run. This is the internet age, and people are already withdrawing incredible amounts of cash to stuff under the mattress or bury in the backyard. I'd call it an internet rumor, except that the Wall Street Journal, Forbes, and Bloomberg are quietly reporting on this phenomenon. Nobody is sure which bank will go bankrupt next. Meanwhile, the IMF is being kept busy indeed. Hungary is in deep trouble and asking for an IMF loan last week. People all over Eastern Europe are in distress, partly because their mortgages were in Swiss francs, not local currency. The East European currencies have collapsed, and so has their economy. More foreclosures and a return to poverty not seen since Soviet times is possible. The same thing, complete with IMF bailout, has happened to the Ukraine. The Ukraine, of all places. Eastern Europe is well off compared with affairs in South America. The Brazilian stock market has crashed. Foreign capital is rushing towards the exits. Development may stop. It looks like Argentina may go bankrupt for the second time in 6 years. The government of Argentina just seized about $30 billion worth of private pensions in order to stave off complete collapse. It may not work. Their banking system is in tatters. Even the fast-growing Asian economies are suddenly tumbling. South Korean banks are in deep trouble. The government is trying to rescue them. The Korean stock market is bleeding. Japan's stock market just hit a 20-year low, breaking boundaries no one expected. Foreign-funded projects in India are grinding to a halt. Half of all Chinese toy factories, thousands of them, have closed. Chinese exports are dropping, and millions of workers are becoming unemployed. Some of them thrown out while still owed the last few months of their wages, nobody to pay them. No one can tell what this might mean politically anywhere in Asia. Did I mention that Pakistan is approaching bankruptcy with an IMF bailout and a civil war as well, in a nuclear-armed country complete with radical extremists? How bad can it get? This is James McMurdy.
There's a Vietnam vet with a cardboard sign sitting there by the left turn line. Flag on his wheelchair flapping in the breeze. One leg missing and both hands free. no one's paying much mind to him. The VA budget's just stretched so thin, and now there's more coming back from the Mideast war. We can't make it here anymore. And that big old building was a textile mill. It fed our kids and it paid our bills, but they turned us out and they closed the doors. We can't make it here anymore. You see those pallets piled up on the loading dock? They're just gonna sit there till they rot, 'cause there's nothing to ship, nothing to pack, just busted concrete and rusted tracks. Empty storefronts around the square, there's a needle in the gutter and glass everywhere. You don't come down here unless you're looking to score. We can't make it here anymore. The bar's still open, but man, it's slow. The tip jar's light and the register's low. The bartender don't have much to say. The regular crowd's getting thinner each day. Some have maxed out all their credit cards. Some are working two jobs and living in cars. Minimum wage won't pay for a roof. Won't pay for a drink if you gotta have proof. Try it yourself, Mr. CEO. See how far 5:15 an hour will go. Take a part-time job at one of your stores. I bet you can't make it here anymore. And there's a high school girl with a bourgeois dream, just like the pictures in the magazine she found on the floor of the laundromat. A woman with kids can forget all that. If she comes up pregnant, what'll she do? Forget the career, forget about school. Can she live on faith, live on hope, high on Jesus and hooked on dope? When it's way too late to just say no, you can't make it here anymore. Should I hate a people for the shade of their skin or the shape of their eyes? Yeah, right. Now I'm stocking shirts in the Walmart store, just like the ones we made before. Except this one came from Singapore. I guess we can't make it here anymore. Should I hate a people for the shade of their skin or the shape of their eyes or the shape I'm in? Should I hate them for having our jobs today? No, I hate the men sent the jobs away. I can see them all now, they haunt my dreams, all lily white and squeaky clean. They've never known want, they'll never know need. Their shit don't stink and their kids won't bleed. Their kids won't bleed in their damn little war, and we can't make it here anymore. We'll work for food, we'll die for oil, we'll kill for power, and to us the spoils. The billionaires get to pay less tax, the working poor get to fall through the cracks. So let them eat jelly beans, let them eat cake, let them eat shit, whatever it takes. They can join the Air Force or join the Corps if they can't make it here anymore. So that's how it is, that's what we got, if the president wants to admit it or not. You can read it in the paper, read it on the wall, hear it on the wind if you're listening at all. Get out of that limo and look us in the eye, call us on a cell phone, tell us all why. In Dayton, Ohio, Portland, Maine, or a cotton gin, out on the great high plains, it's done closed down, along with the school and the hospital and the swimming pool. And dust devils dance in the noonday heat, and there's rats in the alley and trash in the street. Gang graffiti on a boxcar door. You can't make it here anymore.
Ready for some tranquilizers? I know I am. Should we switch to American Idol now that reality is just too painful to watch? Ah, no. This is a great opportunity for community building and activism. That is what this program, Radio EcoShock, is all about. Capitalism may be faltering, but lots of people are also organizing for a better system. You'll find events all over your city. Look for them. Go. Participate. Talk to people at work while you still have work. Let's cooperate here. I'm Alex Smith with the Radio EcoShock Show. There are some real solutions out there. It's a new solution to save our atmosphere without spending trillions of taxpayer dollars. It's all about putting carbon back into the soil and into the sea. How can we stop runaway climate change and maybe save ourselves from extinction? That is the question of the day. Today we'll talk answers. No, not 10,000 new nuclear plants or mirrors to deflect the sun. A real way to work with nature to fix the problem. 2 weeks ago, a Radio EcoShock listener sent me a draft paper by Jim Laurie and his futurist friend Seth J. Itzkan. We have Jim Laurie with us to explain an idea that could rock your mind. Jim, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. How you doing?
Doing pretty well, and I'm glad to talk with you. Before we begin, though, I want to ask, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Okay. I got my master's degree in biology at Rice University years ago. I grew up in Pennsylvania, and I was a bird watcher as a kid. And so I studied biology. And then I went to work in the chemical industry for a number of years, and I got a master's degree during that time. In something called Future Studies. And at that time in Houston, we were going to the moon, and it was real exciting. And so I wanted to learn how big systems worked. And that's what I've been doing the last 20 years or so, is trying to understand if we were going to restore a planet or restore an ecosystem, how would we go about it?
Well, the division that you and Seth have developed has two major projects. It's both land and on sea, but I'd like to start with the soil building. How could agricultural methods possibly reduce the amount of greenhouse gases in the air?
Well, when I read Peter Ward's book, I got, kind of in a state of shock, like a lot of folks probably did. And I did a calculation that next morning, and I thought, well, how much carbon are we talking about? And it was, it turned out it was 150 billion tons, 150 gigatons is the number. And there are, if you, after some research, you realize there's about 15 billion acres of land that's been greatly degraded in the last 100 years or so. And that's what it comes to, is it's like 10 tons per acre that if we could put back in the ground. And I think probably the number we could put back into the ground to make the soils healthy again would be 10 times that. Okay. So that would be a sink. That would be a way to do it.
Yeah, but how, we can't just shovel it in there. How are we going to get this, I guess you're talking mostly carbon, back in the ground, eh?
Yeah. Well, the deal is it is photosynthesis. Nature knows how to do that. Technology is like one leg of a table that holds up civilization. The other three legs are biodiversity. And probably the most important thing we have to learn is how to manage grasslands. So the perennial grasses grow really well. And in a lot of places in the world, the perennial grasses have been starving for nutrients because they evolved with grazing animals, but the grazing animals and grasslands co-evolved. And they would grow up shoots, and their growth points were near the surface of the ground. And they'd attract grazing animals. The grazing animals would convert all of that carbon that they'd taken in from the air into dung and urine, and they'd also, it was their own growth, and then they'd leave that behind. Now, the step we didn't know when we started putting cattle inside barbed wire fences years ago was that when buffalo were out there, that they moved as herds, and that was because there were predators around. There were wolves, there were big cats, there were Indians, and so they would move as herds. And when you do that, if you're a buffalo and you bring all your family with you, you've got you're starting to stink up the place after a couple days, and you want to move on. And so they would never rebite the same grass within several weeks or maybe months. And then the story goes down in the soil. There used to be thousands of dung beetles on every acre. They'd follow the herds from the, you know, they could sense the herds from the methane gases that came out or whatever. And they would take, in Oklahoma, they had a rancher that quit using insecticides on his land. And within a couple of years, he noticed that the cow patties were disappearing, and he didn't understand it. And then he realized he had dung beetles on his land, and they were taking them down. And when the Richardsons, a couple from University of Texas, came up and started studying it, they found that these beetles could move a ton of manure per acre in 24 hours down, you know, several feet down into the ground. That in their life cycle, that's where the baby dung beetles get started. And within a couple of years after that, there was so much moisture in his soils that he had worms coming back. And then he had ants in his ground that he hadn't seen in years. And, you know, he had soils that were much healthier than they were earlier on. So
can we integrate that natural system, which was there before probably even humans got to the continent, can we integrate that with our present cattle raising?
Absolutely, and that's the interesting part of the story is this idea started in Africa by a wildlife range manager who was watching lands that he was managing turn to desert. And his name was Alan Savory, S-A-V-O-R-Y. And because of he grew up in Zimbabwe, and because of the civil wars over there and so forth, he eventually had to leave the country. And he came to New Mexico, and he was watching the same process happening in New Mexico and West Texas. That the land was gradually turning to desert in areas where there used to be, you know, really, really strong perennial grasses. And he realized that, you know, for instance, in Pennsylvania where I grew up, if you left the land, you know, if you devastated a piece of land and you left it go, it would grow eventually into a forest, you know, because you have moisture all year round. But in most of the world, if you devastate a piece of land and you just leave it rest, it never comes back. It just turns to desert over time. It gets drier and drier. And he was convinced that the balance between plants and animals and soil microbes and so forth was the key. And so he started trying to move animals and learn about their timing. And after a couple decades, he figured it out. And I've been to ranches out in West Texas where they've got much more grass than they used to have. One ranch in particular, the family was $3 million in debt in the mid-'80s. They were desperate. And they thought they'd taken all the cattle off the land that they could afford to take off. And when they met Savory, they realized that to do a grazing plan that would work, they'd need four times as many cattle. And 8 years later, they had five times the vegetation on their land. And they had dung beetles, and they had a process. And they were also out of debt, which was huge to them. They were talking about taking vacations and doing things they hadn't done in years. And it's real interesting to see, you know, cattle ranchers becoming ecologists and students of dung beetles and so forth. It was quite exciting to meet them.
You even mentioned the role of that underground fungi play in this cycle.
Yeah, I've got a kind of an interesting background. I spent time in Minnesota studying wolves to learn about predators, and then I got a call from California to try to figure out how to restore an area that had turned to desert that used to be redwood forest. You know, the land got so dry, and there was so much erosion. And I realized that fungus, the mycelium networks in the soil were huge in that process. And so I started studying fungi, and I went down to Maryland and worked on a farm for a year to try to learn how to grow mushrooms and things. But that story just keeps getting bigger and bigger. A week ago, I was talking to Paul Hepperly, who works at Rodale. He's the research director down there. And I was asking him, if we can put a ton of carbon in the ground, how much water can it hold? It can hold like 8 pounds or 10 pounds or something like that. And he says, oh, no, you're way off. It's much more than that, that it might be 40. In other words, now you say, well, how do you put it down there? And he's talking about something called glomalin, G-L-O-M-A-L-I-N. It's a new word. It's glycoproteins that were found by this scientist named Sarah Wright at USDA about a decade ago. And she termed them glomalin to, you know. But the glycoproteins, well, that's sugar proteins that are put out by the mycelium network of fungi. They get enormous amounts of sugar from, you know, healthy perennial grasses. The grasses give over half their sugars to the mycelial network to go out and move nutrients in the soil. And essentially it's like an intelligent process in the soil. But because it's like brain tissue, it needs to be kept moist and kept dark. And the way they do this is by putting out these, they ooze out these glycoproteins, and they hold enormous amounts of water. And when we started adding nitrogen to the soil from fertilizers and stuff like that, what that did is it increased bacterial populations, and they started consuming all these carbon networks in the soil, you know. So that's it's interesting because they're finding out at research done at USDA that glomalin or glomalin, however you pronounce it, that there can be four times as much of that as there is of humus in the soil. Humus is more like bug poop.
So we could actually we could grow carbon under the ground and be grabbing it out of the atmosphere.
Absolutely, that's the whole thing. That process used to happen automatically when we had big herds moving under predators, and when we took the predators away, we thought we were overgrazing, and then you know we took more and more animals off the land, and the land never came back. And these were what Savory calls brittle environments. If there was one idea that people could think about in terms of thinking about the system, it's understanding what he means when he talks about brittle environments. And but the exciting part is that all that cast of characters are ready to go back to work.
This sounds to me like instead of it being the energy department that may save our climate, it could be the USDA, it could be agriculture. So what has to get organized to make this work, and what are our goals as far as reduction of greenhouse gases go?
Well, you think about it right now, in agriculture, the people that live on the land are, in a lot of places, barely making it. And we subsidize systems that destroy soils, you know, like they use a lot of fertilizers and chemicals and whatever. And sometimes that's written into their contracts. And what if we were to subsidize ecosystem services? Like if land holds a lot of water, there wouldn't, you know, it would be fewer droughts and fewer floods too, quite ironically. And if the land had more carbon in it, it would be, you know, helping with the climate situation. And so there's a guy that I met recently named Abe Collins up in Vermont who's a dairy farmer, and he's been working on, you know, how do I grass feed my animals and deepen my soils? And he's got a group called Carbon Farmers of America. And essentially what they're hoping for is that someday he'll be paid by the amount of carbon he's got in his soil. If it increases, he'd get a subsidy. And if it decreases, I don't know, maybe somebody'd have to pay into the system. I don't know. But he figures that the ecosystem services of a ton of carbon in the soil is probably worth $100 or more. And that might be a cheap way to move towards, security. You know, you say, how do you define security? Well, you know, I think that having a healthy landscape and having a future is a huge part of that. So.
Definitely. Well, we're talking with James Laurie about an important paper he's developing with futurist Seth Itzkan. And let's move from the land to the sea. You know, Jim, as you mentioned, we've recently interviewed Peter Ward, author under Green Sky, and he finds evidence that the great extinctions were driven by changes in the sea, where bacteria belch out toxic hydrogen sulfide. That may be our greatest danger, and you've written about how we might avoid that.
When I read that book last November, I could feel that, you know, I have a lot of experience with hydrogen sulfide in natural systems, and it really makes you sick, and I had nightmares that night thinking about it. And but then I remembered something that people have been asking me, why are there dead zones off the coast of Oregon, or why are there dead zones off Namibia where there's no industry at all? And what I think is happening is that, you know, there's in Namibia, for instance, there's big upwellings of nutrients at certain times of the year from the Antarctic currents, and there used to be like billions of sardines that would eat the algae. And if the algae doesn't get eaten, it'll eventually it'll form mats and so forth. It'll start sinking to the bottom, and it won't be able to trap sunlight anymore. And it starts decaying at the bottom of the ocean and creating these huge dead zones. And that's similar to what Peter Ward describes. If we melt the ice and the ocean can't breathe anymore, eventually it'll start dying from the bottom up. You know, so then you start thinking, well, the symptoms of global warming might be ice melting and dead zones in the ocean. But one, you know, one way to reverse that is make sure that our algae-eating fish are healthy. And that went back to something I'm really incredibly interested in, is how do we restore the cod fishery off New England and Nova Scotia? And it comes back to a little fish called the menhaden, what we called in Maine the pogie. And, you know, and now think if you're an algae-eating fish, you know, where would you want to live? You know, and it'd be like, well, you'd follow the plankton. You'd go, you'd follow wherever that stuff was growing. Well, it doesn't grow all year round in New England. So they tend to migrate south in the wintertime, and they come back up north in the summertime. But we fish them out to such an extent that they don't make it to New England as much as they used to. You know, they don't have to go that far. There's not as many of them.
This is the menhaden you're talking about.
What's that?
That's the menhaden fish you're talking about?
Yeah, the menhaden fish. It's like when there were schools of these fish that were the size of counties, you know, like hundreds of square miles possibly, they essentially fed bluefish, striped bass, swordfish, cod, mackerel, mammals, whales, and seals, and on and on and on. It was like menhaden are like the experts at turning algae and phytoplankton into oil. And they're bony and they're not good to eat. But it used to be there were so many in New England that when the bluefish would capture a group of them and try to consume them, they'd run everywhere they could, and a lot of them would end up on the coast of New England and in the rivers and whatever. And, the colonists would pick them off the ground and squeeze the oil out of them and then use the rest of the fish to spread on the land. It was like a nutrient that it was added to the soil. It's the Squanto story of the Pilgrim days. And that fish, I think, is the basis of the whole ocean food chain here. And, the more we study this, the more we're going to see that the carbon cycle is mostly about algae taking it out of the air and it going into, you know, moving up these food webs. And the algae-eating fish, the menhaden and the sardines and the anchovies are really important. You know, out where you are on the West Coast, they've got those dead zones in Oregon. Well, there used to be huge sardine fisheries off the coast of California, which don't exist anymore. And I think restoring those would be just, I mean, eventually that'd be a huge economic plus, you know. And I'm kind of thinking if we want the cod to come back in New England, we're going to have to face the food chain issue and figure out how to restore menhaden. And,
Right, we cut out one of these important links. They seem like a small fish that nobody knows about, but then the algae can become toxic, create the dead zones, and the bigger fish don't grow, so we don't actually get the food fish that we wanted. So I can see there's a lot of work to be done there. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking with Jim Laurie about a new proposal to use both land and sea to reduce greenhouse gases and maybe save the climate of the world. Jim, where do you go from here? If people want to find out more, where can they connect with your new ideas?
Well, Steph and I are putting together a Google group called Soil Age, and it's got a dash in the middle of it, SOIL-AGE. And that's just starting, and we're not sure where it's going to go, but we're going to put the paper on there, and we're going to put references to where you can learn more about ecosystems and how they work. And I would suggest that people look up Holistic Management, which is the group that was started by Alan Savory in New Mexico. And there's one paper that's on there that's called News You Can Use, and they essentially have a dozen case studies of ranchers and farmers that have used this holistic management process to improve their land and their soil and their communities too. So, and another is about menhaden. There's a book that was recently written by Bruce Franklin, who's at Rutgers University, and he's a fisherman, and he went through the whole history of menhaden, and he wrote a book called The Most Important Fish in the Sea. And I think if light was brought to that, that would be a huge step. And those are some of the places.
Good enough. Okay, well, it's been really fascinating talking with you, and I think I'm going to try and develop some more about your paper with our listeners as we progress. Our guest has been James Jim Laurie, spelled L-A-U-R-I-E. He's produced a new program with Seth J. Itzkan, spelled I-T-Z-K-A-N, for rehabilitation of both land and sea called Soil Restoration, Ocean Anoxia, and Menhaden Reduction. I think this plan could work. You're going to be hearing a lot more about it. Thanks for being with us, Jim.
Okay, thank you.
All right, I'm Alex Smith reporting for Radio EcoShock. This is Radio EcoShock. Light up your iPod or computer with tons of free green audio from our website at www.ecoshock.org. That's E-C-O, shock like an electric shock, .org. Time to wrap it up for this week on Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Tune in next week for a major speech on the sad state of the oceans. Canada has the world's longest coastline, but mismanagement has crashed commercial stocks that used to feed the world. Now warnings of continuing extinctions are being ignored by the government. Professor Jeff Hutchings, Lament for a Nation's Oceans, is next on Radio EcoShock. Thank you so much for listening. We'll go out with a new discovery. Social poet and singer Eliza Gilkyson, spelled G-I-L-K-Y-S-O-N, from Austin, Texas. I expected a new breed of artists from our developing social woes, and Gilkyson does it for me. This is a clip from Runaway Train.
Everyone knew she was gonna be fast. Everyone said they could build her to last. 10,000 tons of hurtling steel, screaming around the curve, nobody at the wheel. Everyone said, don't pay it any mind. There's a pot of gold waiting at the end of the line. Just move with the eye of the hurricane. We'll never get off of this runaway train. Nobody cared when they piled on board and the door snapped shut and the engines roared. They pushed to the front, they fell to the back, buying and selling every inch of the track. Pitiful few sounding.